Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people, to make informed food choices, and to debunk myths about vegetarianism and animal rights. You can learn more about who we are and what we do by visiting our website, CompassionateCooks.com. I also encourage you to visit and join our message board to find community and camaraderie and support. You can find it by going to CompassionateCooksCommunity.com. I also want to remind you that if you want to help spread the word about this podcast in a way that will encourage people to listen, hopefully, we have podcast sampler CDs and you can order them at our website. I'd also like to announce that a new CD is hot off the presses. It's called Compassion in Action, The Joys and Benefits of Living Vegan. And the intention in creating this CD was to express just that in a 70-minute CD. And I'm sure you appreciate how difficult that was for me to do, considering the fact that these episodes, these podcast episodes, now average 40, 45, sometimes 50 minutes. So imagine trying to compress all of this down into 70 minutes. And I made this CD for vegans and non-vegans, mostly for non-vegans. For vegans and listeners of this podcast, I don't think you'll learn much that's new on the CD. You know my basic approach to and philosophy of what it means to be vegan, and that is, in short, to try and create as little harm as possible and as much compassion as possible in this world. For me, being vegan is about being unconditionally compassionate, not trying to attain some impossible level of perfection. Being vegan is a means to do that, to be fully compassionate. It's certainly not an end. So I wanted to express this in a CD so that you can most certainly feel inspired to remember that, but also so that you can share this with non-vegetarian friends and family. Marty and Wendy Beckers, dedicated listeners and sponsors of this podcast, generously sponsored the first batch of CDs because they really wanted me to do this. It's because of them that we even have the podcast sampler CDs and now the Compassion in Action CD. So thank you, Marty and Wendy. They'll be the first to tell you that they did it for totally selfish reasons. They wanted to have something they could give to non-vegetarian friends and family members and coworkers and such who say, now, why vegan? What's this all about? So we came up with the CD for that very reason. It's for people like Marty and Wendy who want someone to speak on their behalf about what it means to be vegan and all the joys and benefits of being vegan. And whereas vegans will hopefully be inspired by the message on the CD, it really was created as a vegan 101, a why vegan, for people who are curious about what it means to live this joyful lifestyle. The CD is 70 minutes long, and the chapters are as follows. There's an introduction, but after that, there are about 10 chapters. The first chapter is defining vegan. The second is called health benefits. The third is the nutrients we need are plant-based. Four is making a difference. Five is humane. Meat, dairy, and eggs. Six is creating new habits. Seven is debunking common myths. Eight is living our values. Nine is learning from the animals. And the 10th chapter is basically a chapter of resources and recommendations to guide people to other places, books, films, and this podcast so they can learn more information after they listen to the CD. You can order it from the website, CompassionateCooks.com. It's $5 a CD, and it comes in a beautifully designed CD wallet that Marty and Wendy also designed. So it's a lovely gift with what I think is a very important message that the world needs to hear. So Compassion in Action, The Joys and Benefits of Living Vegan. It's on the website under Shop or under what's now called Cookbook/DVD as a menu header, but it will soon also include CD. It'll say Cookbook DVD CD. And on the page where you buy the CD, you can listen to a sample chapter to give you an idea of what it's all about or direct friends or family there so they can find out what it's all about. So there you have it. There you have it. Before we get to the topic for today, I'd like to thank our listener sponsors. First, thank you to Hannah Smeltz, who generously sponsored the podcast and did so as a way to mark her one-year veganversary or veganiversary. I guess veganiversary might be the better way to say it, which I think is awesome. I feel so privileged and so special that you marked your one-year anniversary by sponsoring this podcast. So thank you very much, Hannah, and I hope you're doing fantastically well. Our second sponsor is Keena Pierce, who wrote at the time of her sponsorship several months ago now, "I'm going on my fourth week of veganism. It doesn't feel like it has only been 4 weeks. I feel almost like I've always been vegan because so far I haven't missed much of anything except mac and cheese. And I have a friend that knows how to make it with nutritional yeast, so we're going to do that next week. Truth be told, I never ever considered becoming vegan before 4 weeks ago. I think that my friends and family are waiting to see how long it lasts. Let them wonder. I usually find it difficult to stick to my guns, but not this time. I feel so good about this decision. None of that nagging, second guessing. I will never go back. On a more random note, I've lost 7 pounds, which is a nice perk. I never would have done it without your podcast. I didn't really mean to listen, but once I did, I could not turn it off, and now I am more informed, more educated, more enlightened, and I own lots of animal rights, environmental, and vegan books." Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Keena, for your sponsorship. Thank you for your openness. You rock. You rock. And finally, thank you to Leslie Gandy. Leslie wrote, "Thank you so much for all you do. I look forward with eager anticipation to new podcast episodes. I've become vegan as a result of listening and learning, and I feel better and happier than ever before." Thank you, Leslie. Any chance you're hearing a recurring theme here when it comes to how people describe being vegan? Does anyone else hear this? I feel better than ever before. I feel happier than ever before. I feel more joyful than ever before. That's what I'm talking about. Lots of joyful vegans out there. And incidentally, I really didn't even mean to segue into this, but it's a perfect segue. I'm this close to releasing a new line of t-shirts for men and women and children and youth that say joyful vegan. There's no other shirt, there's no other expression out there of this feeling. So the shirts will say joyful vegan. And one design is more feminine than the other, but there will be lots of choices in lots of colors. So stay tuned. Keep checking the website, compassionatecooks.com, for updates. They'll be available literally any day. I'm so excited, and we can all now proudly wear our joy on our sleeves, quite literally. So thank you, everybody. Thank you to the listeners. Thank you to the sponsors. Thank you to Marty and Wendy. If you'd like to sponsor this podcast, it could really use your help. You can do so by going to compassionatecooks.com and clicking on sponsor the podcast, and you receive some gifts in return. You can sponsor monthly, which is a big help, or you can sponsor one time, which is also a huge help. So whatever you can do, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. So it's time to get to our topic for the day. It's about our lifestyle. It's about how our lifestyles are literally killing us, how we are literally killing ourselves with the way we're living. Now, you've probably heard that people are dying every day from diseases all around the world. And when we talk about disease, what we really need to do is differentiate between infectious diseases and what are known as lifestyle diseases or diseases of civilization. This is not my word for it. I swear this is what it's called. Infectious diseases, also called contagious diseases or communicable diseases, are diseases that have come about because of the presence of microorganisms such as viruses or bacteria, fungi, protozoa, parasites, and aberrant proteins known as prions. Now, you may remember hearing a lot about prions when there were a lot of news stories about mad cow disease, or BSE, bovine spongiform encephalopathy. Now, these diseases, infectious diseases, can be spread directly or indirectly from one person to another. Now, zoonotic diseases are infectious diseases of animals that can cause disease when transmitted to humans. And I plan on doing an entire episode or more on the diseases that we now suffer from because of our domestication of and our consumption of non-human animals. But that's for another time. That's for another episode. Some examples of infectious diseases include HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, which was also considered consumption. Obviously, it's called TB also, but it was called consumption as well. Measles, pertussis, aka whooping cough, tetanus, meningitis, syphilis, hepatitis B, herpes, malaria, mumps, influenza, chickenpox, and ringworm. These are all infectious diseases. And as you know, a human-to-human infectious disease could be passed through blood, mucus, uterine fluid, breast milk, semen, saliva, or breath. For example, respiratory diseases and meningitis are commonly spread by sneezing, coughing, talking, or kissing. Gastrointestinal diseases are often acquired by ingesting contaminated food or water. Sexually transmitted diseases are acquired through contact with bodily fluids. Now, some infectious agents may be spread as a result of contact with a contaminated inanimate object. It doesn't have to be a person. It could be a coin passing from one person to another, and other diseases penetrate the skin directly. Now, we've come a long way in learning about how to prevent many of these diseases by practicing safer sex, by washing our hands more frequently, by properly disposing waste. Vaccines is another way we've come to prevent these diseases. But we still might accidentally acquire a communicable disease just by touching a doorknob someone else has used, someone who's been contaminated. And in fact, with the discovery of the germ theory of disease in the second half of the 19th century, hygiene and sanitation have been at the forefront of the struggle against illness and disease. Infectious disease, that is. Now, I'm sure you remember learning all about the Middle Ages when the average human life expectancy didn't reach beyond the teen years or early adulthood. Much of the world at this time lived in incredibly unsanitary environments. Hygiene was poor, sanitation was nearly non-existent, and diseases such as the bubonic plague, typhus, smallpox, and tuberculosis consumption took a huge toll on the population, both young and old. Though some people had identified the relationship between the occurrence of disease and environmental influences, nonetheless, it was a very long time before public policy reflected these theories. Hippocrates, the Greek physician who lived from around 460 BC to 370 BC, is considered the father of epidemiology. Epidemiology is just the study of factors affecting the health and illness of populations, and it serves as the foundation of interventions made in the interest of public health and preventive medicine. Hippocrates was the first to reject the belief that supernatural forces caused illness and believed that illness was not a punishment inflicted by the gods, as many people believed at one point, but rather the product of environmental factors, diet, and living habits. This is what Hippocrates had hypothesized back then, a long time ago. But between his time and the mid to late 19th century, there was little improvement in living standards until the advances of the Industrial Revolution and the discovery of the germ theory of disease, which brought about huge sweeping public health measures that culminated in the rise of the scientific era of medicine, particularly the science of epidemiology. Now, for all intents and purposes, the science of epidemiology was founded by John Snow's identification of a polluted public water well as the source of an 1854 cholera outbreak in London. From this point on, public health interventions, such as building latrines and sewers, the regular collection of garbage followed by incineration or disposal in a landfill, and the provision of clean water and draining standing water to prevent the breeding of mosquitoes, greatly reduced the spread of infectious diseases in developed countries. Now, many people in developing countries still suffer from water and sanitation-related diseases, and we know now what we need to do to prevent these diseases as developed nations support the infrastructure needed for clean water and sanitation systems in developing nations. Drastic changes take place in terms of preventing these infectious diseases, so it's very simple in that sense. So we know what to do. We know what to do now in terms of infectious diseases in many cases. So many good things obviously came from the Industrial Revolution, and in many ways, our lifestyles improved. In quotes, improved. Because at the same time our lifestyles improved, we also took a turn for the worst. Though now we were saving ourselves from such killers such as the bubonic plague and pneumonia, diseases that you might now say were spread because of lack of information, because of ignorance, these diseases were killing us. We didn't know what was going on. We didn't know what to do about them. They were literally killing us. But as things started to shift and we began to settle into a comfortable way of living, we began shifting from infectious diseases to what are essentially lifestyle diseases or diseases of civilization. Now, what are these diseases of civilization, in quotes? They include Alzheimer's disease, atherosclerosis, asthma, cancer, chronic liver disease or cirrhosis, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, hypertension or high blood pressure, nephritis or chronic renal failure, osteoporosis, stroke, depression, diverticulitis, gallstones, and obesity. Do any of these sound familiar to you? Do you know anyone who has suffered from the bubonic plague? Probably not. Do you know anyone with high blood pressure? Probably. Now, let me put this in perspective for you. In 1900, pneumonia and influenza, as one, tuberculosis, and diarrhea were the top three causes of death in the U.S., with 60% of all deaths attributed to infectious disease, okay? Heart disease in 1900 was the fourth leading cause of death. Today, it's number one in both men and women. In 1900, diabetes was 27th on the list of causes of death. Okay, 27th. Cancer was way down in 8th position. Now, that was in 1900. By 1950, cancer had become the third leading cause of death. Today, it's second only to heart disease in both men and women. From the 1940s to the late 1990s, heart disease, cancer, and degenerative diseases such as diabetes, cirrhosis, kidney failure, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease accounted for the maximum number of deaths. The World Health Organization estimates that atherosclerosis and type 2 diabetes kill about 20 million people every year, more than are killed by war, famine, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined, and more than might conceivably be killed in a single pandemic of bird flu. Now, not that these diseases aren't worthy of our consideration, but you see what I'm getting at here. Whereas I hear a lot about AIDS on the news and concerns about the outbreak of bird flu, the diseases, read, the preventable diseases that most people are dying from now are so commonplace that they rarely make the news. Also, according to the World Health Organization, world deaths from quote-unquote lifestyle diseases will double by 2015, which is like, what, around the corner, unless all-out efforts are taken to combat them. And we have what we need to combat them. Cardiovascular conditions, diabetes, lung disease, and some cancers together account for some 44% of all premature deaths, or twice that of all infectious diseases worldwide. Half of cardiovascular deaths occur in people under 70 years old, and at least 90% are preventable with simple lifestyle changes. Now, to be clear, I mentioned above, the phrase diseases of civilization isn't something I made up. It comes from the French physician Stanislas Tanchu, who in 1843 analyzed death registries and concluded that cancer was more common in cities than it was in rural areas, and that the incidence of cancer was increasing throughout Europe. What we now know, what he was seeing, is that lifestyle diseases increase in frequency as countries become more industrialized and people live longer. Put it this way, according to the World Health Organization, people who live in high-income countries and middle-income countries predominantly die of chronic diseases such as cardiovascular disease, chronic obstructive lung disease, cancers, diabetes, and dementia. In low-income countries, people predominantly die of infectious diseases such as lung infections, diarrheal diseases, HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. The correlation is as plain as the nose on my face. Even conservative organizations like the American Heart Association will tell you that simply eating a healthy diet, exercising regularly, and avoiding tobacco could prevent 80% or more of all premature deaths from cardiovascular disease and stroke. Now, of course, the key here is the loose interpretation of healthy diet, and that's another story. But what we know for a fact, is that we can prevent these lifestyle diseases by changing our lifestyles. This is undeniable, it's indisputable, and it's widely documented. So why aren't we doing more about it? If these diseases are preventable, why aren't they being prevented, like smallpox and the plague and polio? Well, I think we have to take a look at Greek mythology for one of the answers to that question. You remember Apollo, right? Among other things, Apollo was the god of healing. He had a son named Asclepius, and Asclepius was worshipped as the god of medicine. Asclepius had six daughters, each of whom performed some facet of healing. One was the goddess of recuperation, one was the goddess of recovery, one was the goddess of longevity, one was the goddess of natural beauty. The two we care about are Panacea and Hygieia. Panacea was the goddess of cures. Hygieia was the goddess of disease prevention. You can see where we got our word for hygiene. It's from Hygieia. Now, of all these goddesses that we could have worshipped, who did we choose? We chose Panacea, the goddess of cures, the goddess of the cure-all. We have all but abandoned Hygieia, the goddess of disease prevention. Under Panacea would fall the surgeries and invasive procedures and drugs and pharmaceuticals, quick fixes that focus on the symptom rather than the problem, that focus on the effect rather than the cause. And as we worship Panacea, we are indeed living longer, but we are not living well. We have longer lives, but unhealthier lifestyles. And until we embrace Hygieia, the goddess of disease prevention, we're going to continue to suffer from self-inflicted lifestyle-related diseases. Now let's take a look at just a couple of these diseases one by one and see how we respond to them according to Panacea and according to Hygieia, and see what kind of hope we have to prevent them in our own individual lives. Now, I'm just taking a cursory look at a couple of these to demonstrate how backwards our approach is. I could do, you know, full episodes on each one alone. I could do several episodes on each one alone. So let's start with atherosclerosis. Now, atherosclerosis is a chronic disease whereby the arteries become clogged by the buildup of fatty substances, which eventually reduce the blood flow to the tissues, okay? Now, these fatty substances are called plaque, and they're made up largely of cholesterol. In so-called westernized societies, this disease begins in childhood, and it progresses unless lifestyle is changed. Now, it's really important that I make this point about atherosclerosis. It begins in childhood. One of the things that drives me crazy is when I hear people say, "Oh, so-and-so died of a heart attack. It was really sudden. It was so unexpected. He was like in perfect health, and then he died of a heart attack." Please hear me now and hear me clearly. Healthy people don't die of disease. Healthy people don't die of atherosclerosis. If he died of a heart attack, he was not healthy, right? But part of the problem is we don't have nerve endings in our hearts, so we don't get the signs that something's wrong. You know, we see it in some blood work, we see it in maybe our weight, in these kind of risk factors and these kind of signs, but we even ignore them. So what happens is it's been building up, we don't have nerve endings, so we don't feel it, doesn't hurt us until there's the attack, until blood can't get to the heart anymore, and the heart can't pump if there's no blood and oxygen. So it's not that someone was perfectly healthy and died of a heart attack. They were sick. Their arteries were clogged. This stuff starts so early. It starts in childhood, and it progresses slowly into adulthood. Again, even the most conservative organizations, the American Heart Association declares this, and this is what the evidence shows. It progresses as we get older, but not because we're just getting older, but because with each passing day, we continue to participate in the behaviors that cause our arteries to get clogged. I can't stand when I hear people, like people my parents' age, say, "Well, my cholesterol's going up and my blood pressure's going up, and you know, so-and-so has osteoporosis. That's just what happens when you get old." I can't think of a more disempowering statement than that. These things don't just happen because we age. It's not inevitable that we get these diseases. We play a huge role in the development of these diseases, and particularly in atherosclerosis. So, and when I say we play a huge role and the development of these diseases, that's not to say that I want us to flog ourselves and blame ourselves if we do develop these diseases. I'm not saying it to make us feel bad or guilty, but I do think we need to take responsibility for what we're doing to ourselves. The fact that we can make a difference in our health is incredibly empowering. We have the power to make a difference in our own health, in our own lives. But that's also really scary to people because it means that we have the power to do it. We have a lot more power than we think. And the choices we make really do affect our health. It's up to each one of us to take that power and use it in a productive, positive way rather than in a destructive way. So I just want to make that clear. Now, so you've got these arteries, right? And these arteries are going to the heart. Now, they get clogged up with these fatty substances, making it difficult for blood to get to the heart. A heart attack, aka myocardial infarction, which you've probably heard, occurs when one of the atherosclerotic plaques ruptures, creating a total blockage, which results in a restriction of the blood supply and oxygen going to the heart. According to the American Heart Association, some 16 million people, 8,700,000 men and 7,300,000 women are living with some form of coronary heart disease. 1,200,000, 1.2 million people suffer a new or recurrent coronary attack every year, and about 40% of them die as a result of the attack. So you've got 1.2 million people having a heart attack, and almost half of these people die from that attack. This means about every 26 seconds, an American will suffer a coronary event, and about every 60 seconds, someone will die from one. And how are we treating this? Well, let's look at the panacea approach of clearing the arteries. Surgery, particularly procedures such as coronary artery bypass surgery, which reroutes or bypasses blood around clogged arteries to improve blood flow and oxygen to the heart. Now, the terms single bypass and double bypass and triple bypass and quadruple bypass, even quintuple bypass, refer to the number of coronary arteries bypassed in the procedure. In other words, a double bypass means two arteries are being bypassed, a triple bypass means three arteries, three vessels are bypassed, and quadruple, and so on. According to the American Heart Association, 427,000 coronary artery bypass graft surgeries, they're called CABG surgeries, coronary artery bypass graft surgeries, were performed in the United States in 2004, and this number is just going up, making it one of the most commonly performed major operations. Doesn't that bother you? This is a common operation now. It's just common, right? Now, I'm personally fascinated by this. I'm personally fascinated by the fact that we know that lifestyle factors contribute to plaque buildup. We know that this disease can not only be prevented, but reversed when we make lifestyle changes. But we've come to believe that surgery is the easy route, the easy answer, right? I mean, having your chest cut open is easier than making a few lifestyle changes that have far-reaching benefits for your health, for your heart, for your spirit, for the animals, for the earth. So because this is so commonplace and we don't really think about it much, I thought I would read to you a description of the details of a bypass surgery, just so you can keep this image in your mind if you're ever faced with this. Now, this is just from like the American Heart Association's website. This isn't embellished at all for effect. This is like straight on from their website. Here goes. The cardiac surgeon makes an incision down the middle of the chest and then saws through the breastbone. The heart is cooled with iced salt water while a preservative solution is injected into the heart arteries. Before bypass surgery can take place, a cardiopulmonary bypass must be established. Plastic tubes are placed in the right atrium to channel venous blood out of the body for passage through a plastic sheeting in the heart-lung machine. The oxygenated blood is then returned to the body. The main aorta is clamped off during coronary artery bypass graft surgery to maintain a bloodless field and to allow bypasses to be connected to the aorta. Now, compare that with something like another approach, or, you know, kind of an alternative approach, a little less invasive. Okay. So take a cup of green split peas and add it to a soup pot with kale, diced potatoes, one chopped onion, a chopped carrot, and minced garlic. Throw in your favorite fresh or dried herbs, add enough water to cover, cook over low to medium heat for about 40 minutes or until the split peas are completely cooked down and almost mushy. Repeat this several times a month or as many times as you desire and eat until your heart is content. Now, I'm not trying to be flippant about this, but this is really what it comes down to. You change some habits, you learn to eat healthfully, exercise, or you have your chest cut open and your sternum sawed through. This is what we're talking about here. Now, coronary angioplasty is another panacea-type procedure whereby a balloon-tipped catheter is inserted into the artery to open it up. You know, it's been choked by fat-laden plaque, so they insert this catheter to kind of open up that artery. Now, angioplasty is done on more than 1 million people a year in the United States. So how's it working? How are these common procedures, these common surgeries or procedures in the case of the angioplasty, how's it working? Well, cardiologists have found that 5 years after coronary artery bypass graft surgery is performed, nearly 40% of grafts show the return of disease. In 10 years, 75% show disease. Coronary angioplasty is not much better. 6 months after surgery, an estimated 30 to 50% of arteries are blocked again. Surprise, surprise, right? Now, these procedures obviously head off heart attacks by maintaining blood flow to the heart muscle, but they do nothing to alter the underlying process that caused the atherosclerotic plaque to accumulate in the first place. And I would argue that with these surgeries being so commonplace in our society, it actually makes people sicker. You know, I have to say my in-laws, who I love them, I absolutely adore them, but my mother-in-law doesn't really ever have this conversation with me. She doesn't want to have this conversation with me, and she's on several different types of medication. And what's so sad to me is that she attributes her health to these pills. I mean, she really attributes, like, look, this is the way it is. If we didn't have these pills, we'd be dead right now, you know? And that's kind of the panacea type attitude, you know? If you don't do the surgery, you're going to die. If you don't take this pill, you're going to die. And that's a very different kind of attitude than, you know, taking control and taking responsibility and actually reversing the disease that you have so that you don't have to live on pharmaceutical drugs your entire life. And so you don't have to go through these very invasive, very dangerous surgeries. There's a lot of risks when you go in for these surgeries that people don't talk about. And again, that's just a whole other episode that we can get into. But, you know, I understand that these surgeries are saving lives, but I would actually argue that because they're so commonplace, they actually make people sicker, including the pharmaceuticals, including the drugs. Because when people think that they can do anything they want because a cure or a quick fix is just around the corner, a panacea is just around the corner, they become complacent. They make no lifestyle changes. They stay sick. They continue clogging their arteries and they return for one surgery, you know, after another. I mean, because most people who've had one angioplasty or one bypass surgery have to go back for another. Now, can you imagine if before they went into these surgeries, right, if before they went in, the doctors were like, look, there's a maximum number of one surgery per person. So we're going to do this surgery for you. But now you need to take care of yourself so that you could prevent the atherosclerosis. I don't want to see you again. This is your one shot to clean it up. Now it's up to you. Can you imagine if there was like a maximum number? Like, sorry, that, you know, you had your chance, especially if the doctors told them what to do so that they really could make the changes they need to. But instead, the doctors enable the patient, really. They enable them to stay sick. They provide no alternatives to surgery, or if they do recommend diet changes, they're so small as to have no or little effect at all. And they even contribute to the disease. And I say contribute with confidence because have you ever seen what heart patients are fed when they come out of surgery? They're given the same artery clogging crap that put them there in the first place. It's just a sick cycle. It's just this horrible cycle that keeps people sick, and it's killing animals by the millions, killing people by the millions, killing animals by the millions. It literally makes me heartsick, literally. Now, I bring up animals on purpose. Most of you know why. When we talk about the substances that clog our arteries, in short, we're talking about saturated fat and cholesterol. When we consume saturated fat and dietary cholesterol, it increases our own body's production of cholesterol. And the primary source of saturated fat and the only source of dietary cholesterol is animal products. When we stop consuming animal products, saturated fat, dietary cholesterol, we see amazing results take place. Now, that would be Hygieia's way of attacking this problem. So we know that elevated cholesterol and triglycerides, elevated triglycerides as well, they're one of the markers for cardiovascular disease. Well, if we know that lifestyle changes lower our cholesterol, namely eliminating saturated fat and cholesterol, i.e. animal products from our diet, losing weight, and exercising. So if we know that, why aren't we doing it? Well, because we worship the goddess Panacea. And we've been told that by taking a little pill every day, or two, or three, or four, depending on how many lifestyle diseases you have, you can continue doing what you do. No need to change. Who doesn't love that? Who doesn't want to be told that they can, you know, say, lower their cholesterol and do nothing but take a pill every day? Who doesn't love that, right? But once again, here we have a situation where we're not addressing the problem. Elevated cholesterol is a risk factor. People don't die of elevated cholesterol. It's a sign that something's wrong. It's a sign that something's really out of whack, because now we're so advanced that we're able to read these signs that our body's giving us, you know, in these very scientific ways. We're able to see that, oh, elevated cholesterol, risk of a heart attack. So we can tell that if someone has high cholesterol, it's a sign that something's wrong. But instead of addressing the something that's wrong, people are led to believe that they're taking care of the problem by just addressing the signpost, the danger sign. It's like removing the sign that says oncoming train. Well, you might have removed the sign, but the train's still coming. You're not cured when you take cholesterol-lowering drugs. Far from it. Now, I'm not going to give you medical advice here and tell you that you should or should not be on cholesterol-lowering medication. But what I will tell you is that we need to address the underlying problem. Entire books have been written on the results seen when people are put on a low-fat, plant-based diet. Check out the work of Dr. McDougall, Dr. Furman, Dr. Barnard, Dr. Esselstein, Dr. T. Colin Campbell, Dr. Ornish. There's so many more that I'm not even naming here. The results, when they put people on a low-fat, plant-based diet, are on one hand astounding. On the other hand, they're not so remarkable after all. It's a very simple equation. Now let's look at another popular lifestyle disease that's only getting worse and worse and worse: diabetes. Until very recently, the vast majority of cases of diabetes were type 1. Okay, for a long time, they were type 1, which we call childhood onset diabetes. Now, what used to be called adult onset diabetes is now called type 2, because children are now getting the disease, particularly obese children. Now, remember, in 1900, diabetes was 27th, that's 27, on the list of causes of death. In 1900, 27th place. For at least 20 years now, diabetes rates in North America have been increasing substantially. In 2005, there were about 20.8 million people with diabetes in the United States alone. About 5%, 5 to 10% of diabetes cases in North America are type 1, but the rest are type 2. Now, just so you know the difference, type 1, referred to as childhood onset diabetes, is characterized by loss of the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. We don't have the cells we need to make insulin, okay? Now, type 2 is characterized by insulin resistance, or reduced insulin sensitivity. Now, we're not only seeing type 2 diabetes, the one that really has to do with lifestyle factors, increase in the so-called developed world, we're also seeing a huge increase in developing countries. Why? Well, where there's urbanization and lifestyle changes, euphemistically called lifestyle improvements, i.e. the adoption of a Western-style diet, we see an increase in diabetes. And we see an increase in diabetes because we see an increase in weight. According to the American Diabetes Association, the incidence of type 2 diabetes has increased exponentially in the last 20 years in concert with the increase in obesity. Now, just as people don't die from high cholesterol, they don't necessarily die of obesity either. But it is a risk factor for many, many lifestyle diseases. Two-thirds of the U.S. population is now overweight or obese. And I'm citing a lot of North American and United States statistics here because that's where I live. But other so-called developed nations are not doing much better. I mean, 70% of men and 63% of women in the United Kingdom are overweight or obese. I mean, we see it everywhere we look. So how does a panacea worshiping society address obesity? Gastric bypass surgery, stomach stapling, or even more commonly, nothing. In other words, people who are obese or overweight often have health problems caused by the obesity, right? So atherosclerosis, type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure. And instead of addressing the obesity, they're treated surgically or pharmacologically for the other diseases, and nothing ever changes. Now, In a Hygieia-worshipping society, we'd prevent these diseases in the first place. We'd stop clogging our arteries by eating foods that don't have saturated fat and cholesterol. We'd reduce our waistlines by eating a diet based on low-calorie, low-fat foods, and we'd eat them in abundance. And what are these foods? Plant foods, of course. And of course, exercise is very important. Our sedentary lifestyle most certainly contributes to our weight gain. But our meat, dairy, and egg-based diets play a huge role. And of course, these things are more accessible to people as they gain wealth. But look at what we're buying with our wealth. We are literally buying disease. Is that what we really want? I mean, we've come so far in learning how to prevent infectious diseases, in many cases, we should all be very grateful that we don't have to contend with malaria on a daily basis, that we wake up and have little chance of contracting whooping cough. But what have we traded it for? We have all the information we need to prevent 80% of premature deaths, and we do nothing. We've become so complacent that we give all our power to those who have the most to gain from our complacency. And it's not a matter of, you know, going back to getting infectious diseases, because I've heard people say that. Well, like, what do you want? You want us to go back and get malaria? We don't have to worry about malaria. No, I'm suggesting that we not get malaria or heart disease. Like, we can do both. I hate these, like, stupid black and white responses to things like this. How amazing is it that we are actually at a point in our civilization when we can prevent these, a lot of these infectious diseases, and we can prevent these lifestyle diseases too, but we're not. Now, I want to read you just a brief excerpt from The China Study, a book that I have recommended before and I will recommend again, and I cannot recommend highly enough. Dr. Campbell, a sober scientist of the highest integrity, spends 250 pages of his book explaining why, based on his laboratory and then his clinical research, he recommends a plant-based diet. After several decades of work, this is what he concludes: eat a plant-based diet. And this is what he follows those 250 pages with. Let me just read you an excerpt from that book. So this is basically what he says in response to his recommendation for a plant-based diet. The section is called Part 4, Why Haven't You Heard This Before? And this is what he says. Often when people hear of scientific information that justifies a radical shift in diet to plant foods, they can't believe their ears. If all that you say is true, they wonder, why haven't I heard it before? In fact, why do I usually hear the opposite of what you say? That milk is good for us, that we need meat to get protein, and that cancer and heart disease are all in the genes. These are legitimate questions, and the answers are a crucial part of this story. In order to get these answers, however, I believe that it is essential for us to know how information is created and how it reaches the public consciousness. As you will come to see, much is governed by the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. There are powerful, influential, and enormously wealthy industries that stand to lose a vast amount of money if Americans start shifting to a plant-based diet. Their financial health depends on controlling what the public knows about nutrition and health. Like any good business enterprise, these industries do everything in their power to protect their profits and their shareholders. You might be inclined to think that industry pays scientists under the table to cook the data, bribes government officials, or conducts illegal activities. Many people love a sensational story. But the powerful interests that maintain the status quo do not usually conduct illegal business. As far as I know, they do not pay scientists to cook the data. They do not bribe elected officials or make sordid, underhanded deals. The situation is much worse. The entire system, government, science, medicine, industry, and media, promotes profits over health, technology over food, and confusion over clarity. Most, but not all, of the confusion about nutrition is created in legal, fully disclosed ways and is disseminated by unsuspecting, well-intentioned people, whether they're researchers, politicians, or journalists. The most damaging aspect of the system is not sensational, nor is it likely to create much of a stir upon its discovery. It is a silent enemy that few people see and understand. I really recommend reading this book. Let's not waste another minute taking the information that we do have, that instinct that we do have, and applying it We've all learned to wash our hands after touching an infected doorknob. We teach our children to sneeze into their sleeves. We don't drink from the same glass as someone who's sick. We know how to prevent infectious diseases, and we take the actions necessary to do so. We don't defy science. We do what's necessary to protect ourselves from these communicable diseases. To do any different would be considered masochistic. So why are we being masochistic when it comes to lifestyle diseases? We're armed with all the information we need to prevent these diseases, and yet we defy the truth. For what? For what? My hope is that we will look back on these days of willful destruction and these diseases of civilization and say, what were we thinking? What were we thinking? This is Colleen with Compassionate Cooks. Thanks for listening.